All right, good morning. This is Wade Myers with Venture Radio. I am the host of your program. Venture Radio is all about Christian entrepreneurship, equipping and encouraging Christians to be entrepreneurs if they're not. This morning, we're going to focus on what kind of opportunities to focus on in a downturn, specifically the things that we're facing right now in the economy. A recession, depression, whatever you call this, what makes sense right now? And this is a frequent question that I do get through the website, newventurelab.com, and that we got at the Venture Academy that we recently had. So let me just dive in and give a couple of thoughts on what happens in a downturn and how to think about this. So first of all, it's extremely important for entrepreneurs to properly read the market context. That is, everything that's happening in the market. And as Christian entrepreneurs, as Christ admonished us, we do want to carefully count the cost. We want to be wise and understand the times. So there is a number of resources I would just direct the listeners to right now. One is the blog post, An Analysis of the Great Depression, which is on newventurelab.com. And there's a couple of blog posts called Creative Entrepreneurship in a Downturn, which will have more content as well. So in a downturn, what happens? Well, there's a number of things that happen. And let me start off by giving you a couple of concepts and then some examples for each. So concept number one. Consumers cut back on spending, and as they do that, they cut back on spending of certain items, but demand surges for other items. Specifically, consumers will cut back on spending on expensive, discretionary items, durable goods, automobiles, real estate, new housing, etc. So, example, as the demand for new cars goes down, the demand for car repairs goes up as consumers attempt to get more life out of their current car. It just makes sense. And as the demand for new homes go down, the demand for home repairs, additions, upgrades, you know, rehab, et cetera, goes up as consumers decide to continue living in their current home rather than buy a new one. And no amount of, you know, capital or dollars thrown at that problem, whether it's cash for clunkers or what, can really budge a consumer too far off of where they're at with their context of being concerned about the economy. The bottom line is big purchases are delayed, and current durable goods, the current car, the current house are just extended. So that's one concept. Another concept is as employers in the business realm now, as employers cut back on the number of employees, the demand for outsourcing the tasks that still need to be done goes up. And oftentimes the very employee that got laid off is hired back as a contractor. Other business-to-business demands that tend to go up in a recession, if you're into business-to-business services or products, is that businesses will invest in cost reduction projects. Right now, many companies are basically throwing out their old information technology platforms, for example, and investing in software as a service, SaaS, if you know that acronym, or cloud computing, because it's way more efficient. And it seems maybe like an oddity that they would take an enterprise resource planning system at this stage of the economy and throw it out and embrace a new model, but really they're looking for ways of investing their capital as a company and saying, let's go ahead and invest in real cost reductions. So back to the consumers again. As consumers look for ways to save on their budgets, demand will be created for any product or service that offers the consumers tangible savings. For example, utilities, energy, electricity, gas, etc. That is an area that right now is seeing a lot of demand for cost savings opportunities. A new heating, ventilation, and air conditioning or HVAC system, more insulation, wood-burning stoves. There's lots of things that consumers are still willing to spend on and invest in order to get a real tangible savings. During a recession or energy crunch that we had in the 1970s, as demand for gasoline went down, Americans cut back on unnecessary travel. There was a whole sort of industry that sprung up almost overnight where cars were converted from gasoline to propane. So, you know, and it didn't last real long, but during the gas crunch. So anytime we look at a recession or depression, we have to look at what's happening and then what's being adjusted. And, you know, there was one gentleman that I knew, I think I was only about 19 or 20 years old, and his older brother, who was probably only 22 or 23, rushed into the propane conversion and just made hand over fist for about a year, and then all of a sudden demand fell off, you know, the gas crisis was over, but he's been able to react quickly to what's in demand. Other things that's happening right now is demand for packaged foods and processed foods is slower at stores, and demand for seeds, gardening tools, gardening supplies, et cetera, is on the increase. So consumers are kind of voting with their feet and saying, okay, I'm going to cut down on my expenditures at restaurants and processed foods and try to go and create my own food. So another concept for consumers and what's in demand during a recession is that consumers look for tools and how-to. So books on how to lower your cost of living, books on simple living, books on gardening, books on survival guides, coupon-based tools, coupon-based websites, savings websites, all kinds of – the websites that are doing well right now are the ones that help you find a better deal, right? Another concept during a recession is that the demand for typical investments slow down, and as the value of the dollar drops, then there's a demand for better and higher stores of wealth, if you will, so precious metals and things like that, gold, silver, et cetera. So alternative assets that typically would not be invested in during boom times often come back into vogue during a downturn. Another concept is that there's a growth-oriented business services sometimes slow during a downturn. Sometimes they'll go up depending on what a company's strategy is. But there's a lot of demand for restructuring, for cost cutting. So anything that involves restructuring or cost cutting is big right now in the business-to-business realm. So, for example, a CPA firm that did a lot of acquisition or M&A, mergers and acquisition due diligence during the boom times, might see more demand for restructuring and should, change their value proposition slightly or add to their services bundle to say that we now do these kinds of things. We now come in and renegotiate leases. We offer a whole bundle of services to help you restructure. And so what we see is a pattern in a downturn of consumers looking at their budget and trying to attack or impact or reduce the biggest budget items, housing, automobile, durable goods spending, food, et cetera. And the same with the business. The business will look at their budget and say, okay, people, leases or real estate, et cetera, and try to reduce those kinds of expenses. So that CPA firm, offering lease renegotiation services, a lawyer offering lease renegotiation services, that's big right now. Many large companies are completely restructuring their real estate portfolios because they're letting people go. They don't need all the real estate that they need. And at the same time that real estate values are coming down and lease rates are coming down, they want to get out of expensive leases and get into cheaper leases. All right, another contextual item that happens in a recession or a downturn. During tough times, unfortunately, many will turn to escapism. So, going to the movies to forget their problems for a moment, if you will. We saw this in spades in the Great Depression. And actually, a surprising number of media companies and brands got started during economic downturns. Fortune Magazine, MTV, CNN, USA Today, a whole host of media companies got their start in a downturn. So we see that. So if you're into, making movies or media, just know that typically that demand actually goes up during a downturn. So let me recap a little bit. What gets hit the hardest in a recession or depression? Durable goods, the kinds of purchases you put off until later, new car, new washer, dryer, et cetera. Construction, new home sales always take a huge hit in a downturn. So in short, it's any big budget item that does not have an immediate benefit for the consumer beyond simply improving their lifestyle. That's what's called discretionary spending. All right, so what gets hit the least in a recession or a depression? Basic services. Basic utilities, basic goods. People still need to eat. They still need electricity. They still need to drink water. They still need basic services for, repair services, et cetera. Here's a couple of differences that I was thinking about the other day in terms of the Great Depression versus now. Three categories. One, morality. During the Great Depression, as a nation, our moral base was much different. Americans tended to be more diligent, I think, during the Great Depression than now. They tended to be more patient. There was less crime. So if we look at the moral implications today, we can't draw every lesson from the Great Depression and apply it to today's context because we have other contextual things that have changed. Spiritually, our nation is a completely different place today than we were in the 20s and 30s, leading up into the Depression and during the Depression. Skills. Americans during the Great Depression
knew a lot about animal husbandry. We still had a significant percentage of rural Americans living in a rural environment. They had animal husbandry skills. Many towns allowed people. There was no such rule or law against having a flock of chickens in your backyard, or maybe a couple of goats or a milk cow. A very common thing in the 20s and 30s, leading up to and during the Great Depression, was for a small home with a small yard in a small town with a milk cow and a flock of chickens and a garden. So those kinds of skills were very prevalent to Americans during the Great Depression. They're not so today. Most Americans live in an urban environment or a suburban environment and really have lost those skills over a couple of generations. Skills like hunting, even, the ability to go out and just to hunt game for food. And also just resources. Americans leading up to the Great Depression had a lot more savings. About 10%, most people think, compared to now. Savings is either zero or negative. In fact, it has been negative for several years. So Americans today don't have the savings base that Americans had coming into the Great Depression. Again, Americans typically had a garden already in their backyard. So all they had to do was, plant more, extend it, add a few more rows, right? Maybe switch out what they were growing, tear out the flower garden, plant more vegetables, et cetera. And they had animals. So the resource base in terms of savings, and in terms of having the implements, having the plot of ground already improved. My mother's a master gardener. She would say it takes about 5 years to get a garden plot to where it really produces. So think about today's consumer and their ability to react, and they go in their backyard and plow up their backyard. Well, first of all, their homeowners association isn't going to like that. Many Americans live in a homeowners association. They probably have, rules and restrictions against planting a garden, in your yard, right? But also, if it's going to take 5 years for that garden to become productive, good luck on that. Most homeowners associations also don't allow animals of any sort, what we'd consider livestock, whether it's chickens, poultry, swine, or of any type. So our resource base is different. So we have to keep that in mind as we sort of draw parallels between the Great Depression and now. Some of the questions that I get go along these lines. So what are you personally investing your time and energy in, Wade? And again, I'm not an investment manager, so I'm not here to give investment advice. I'm just here to help offer my entrepreneurial suggestions. But I'll just give you a couple of examples. First of all, I always look for demand megatrends. What is in demand and what will be in demand for a long time, even beyond the current downturn? So one thing that's really in big demand, obviously, is broadband internet access. It's just as important as electricity. And demand is recession-proof. Broadband access continues to grow during this downturn. So that's a big demand megatrend that we can all agree to. And then under the umbrella of a demand megatrend, I look for unmet needs. Now, in my local area in Middle Tennessee, broadband internet access is terrible. It's rarely available, and if it is, it's poor service. So I know that, just in my everyday, life here, I just know that that is an issue. Now, also in terms of unmet demand, there's in my local area, it is a stated objective of the local civil authorities, the city mayor, the county sheriff, the local emergency crews, the ambulance crews, et cetera, the county economic development commission, the regional economic development commission. Everybody's stated goal is to improve broadband access in this area. So what I have now, I'm starting to connect the dots, right? There's a demand megatrend, there's an unmet need, and then I look for available resources. And so, in this case, I've got, two friends that I know well that have the skills, the time, and the interest in pursuing establishing a wireless broadband internet service in this area. So, the people resources are necessary. Infrastructure. There's an abundance of available facilities to house the business and the equipment, lots of empty buildings in my area. There's an abundance of water towers and buildings and hills on which to locate the antennas or the towers. And there is this potential also in terms of infrastructure for, city, county, state, and federal collaboration. There's economic development funds, there's infrastructure investment funds, there's stimulus funds, et cetera, and there's the potential for back office support. So I talked to the city mayor about, you're already doing water billing, you're already doing sewer billing and trash billing and so forth. Could you do billing for the city-based broadband? What if we sort of built this broadband service for the city you know, could we have you do that and include that in your current billing process? So I'm always looking for ways of lowering the cost and lowering the risk. And then other available resources is information resources. So it really interesting, because there's such a desire with the civil magistrates to have broadband access in my area, there's been all kinds of detailed use studies, detailed service maps, and there's other locations nearby that have done this. So there is just it's all the data you'd want as an entrepreneur. It's all there. We can lay out the county use maps, and we can lay out the county availability maps and do the overlay and say, right here, this is the opportunity of need. This is the unmet need that we can go after. So that's an example of business I'm investing time, energy, and money in right now, just kind of connecting the dots, knowing that it is recession-proof. It's a huge mega trend, you know, during recession, you know, downturn and upturn. There's an unmet need, clearly. There are available resources, you know, people, infrastructure, information, capital, et cetera. Now, another question I often get is, well, what about family? What are you doing personally with your family, and what kind of things are you investing in there? And I'd say the key principle right now in the Myers family is to combine several activities to create synergistic value. So whatever we do, we're trying to do a bunch of things at once. So one of my primary goals is to teach my son and my daughters about entrepreneurship. So let's take my son, for example. One of the primary activities I got him in right now at 8 years old is egg production. So we had a chicken coop built by a boy in our church. We bought chickens, we bought feed. And just given that even, I showed him how to, let's set up an income statement, a balance sheet, and a cash flow statement. I described to him why, you know, with the chicken coop and the chickens, we're going to capitalize that. Those are income-producing assets. The feed you expense, right? So it's a platform now to explain to him basic accounting, what do you capitalize, what do you expense, et cetera. Set up a on the computer for him, gave him a laptop, and said, here you go, you know, here's your spreadsheet. This is all your information. It's all integrated. And here's your production reports. And then he inputs his production report, how many eggs were produced. And I show him what eggs are worth and what we're going to pay him for the eggs. I show him how to, you know, manage the chickens, create a chore checklist for him. I get him up early in the morning to do his chores, et cetera. So he's learned about animal husbandry. He's learned about responsibility. He's learned about basic accounting and production reports. He's learned about sacrificing sleep as a you know, man and future family leader. And he's learning how to present his progress. We have weekly family meetings on Saturday afternoons where all the kids bring a thumb drive with their PowerPoint presentations. We have a big projector set up in a conference room, and we have a family meeting, and the kids present what they've learned, what progress they've made in their goals, et cetera. And so he's learning how to prepare a PowerPoint and present a PowerPoint. And importantly, he's contributing to the family economy by producing eggs, so we are less dependent on the grocery store and the economy and inflation, et cetera. It's combining all of those things into one. So that's an example of the kind of thing that I'm investing time and money in as a family. So we're also working on putting in a garden. We bought greenhouse. So we put in an orchard, beef production. We fenced one of our pastures, and we're buying beef and, you know, producing more springs and water production. Fish, we stocked a bunch of fish in one of our ponds, et cetera. Other investments are I bought timber, I bought land, basic infrastructure. I talked about basic goods, basic services, basic infrastructure. I'm invested heavily in real estate management, in financial and accounting services, and, just basic business opportunities. I'm looking for lead management for a number of industries. I'm working on a number of businesses doing that, knowing that companies want business. They want to preserve revenue. They want more customers. They'll pay for that. I'm doing growth consulting and restructuring consulting, and I'm doing mergers and acquisitions work, i.e. helping companies buy companies right now because there's a lot of valuable companies for sale, a lot of companies want to sell, and helping companies sell divisions or doing divestitures. You know, that's where a company sells off a division that they no longer have any interest in pursuing. And I'm pursuing outsourced back office services, i.e. customer service, accounting, that kind of stuff that is considered back office, you know, not frontline like sales and marketing and operations. But anything that is back office that can be performed by off-site, remote contract workers in a cloud computing model. So now, again, I'm an IT entrepreneur. Most of the stuff that I've done in my entrepreneurial career has been information technology related. So I look and of the services nature, right? So I'm looking at the context right now and saying, okay, there's a lot of shakeup with, you know, employees and employees being let go and contractors offshoring, that entire environment. And we have this pending health care legislation that's going to require companies to give health care to their employees. So one of the things that I'm forecasting is that companies will further shrink their employee base and increase contracting. So anything where employees can work from home in a cloud computing model, i.e. using web-based software, as a contractor and doing specific services in a pay-for-performance model, i.e. they get, you know, you process one accounts payable bill, you get paid for processing that bill. So we're no longer having the problem now of how to manage these employees. We're now merely managing contractors based on a service level agreement. So those are the kinds of things that I'm investing in right now. Now, what am I avoiding right now? I'm avoiding anything related to discretionary spending, i.e., you know, travel, leisure, luxury stuff, new housing construction, you know, automobiles, anything along those lines. I'm just flat not interested in it. And I'm also right now avoiding anything related to healthcare, which generally healthcare is a great place to be. We have aging baby boomers that are, you know, into anti-aging and lots of healthcare needs, elder care needs, et cetera. But right now, because of the context of all this regulation underway, right, I don't know what the winning play is going to be. I don't know what the winning business model is going to be, because I'm not sure what the laws and regulations are going to stipulate. And so right now in that particular area, even though generally as a sector, healthcare is a large sector and will continue to grow, people continue to get sick and die and need care, et cetera, during a downturn. But with, given the regulatory context, I'm not playing that game right now, so I'm not in that sector at all right now. I'm sitting that out. So those were a couple thoughts here on Venture Radio with what to do during an economic downturn. And with that, I'm going to open up the program to our callers for questions. We have Kelly from Brush Prairie, Washington on the line. Kelly, go ahead with your question, please.
You talked about resources, and we homeschool our children, Wade, and one of the things that I have a sense that the collective homeschooling community is an undertapped resource, and wanted to know, you know, if you agree with my premise, and if so, are there specific opportunities to greater leverage the talents and skills of that resource set in some kind of an entrepreneurial venture?
So, Kelly, when you say untapped resource, can you just expand on that a little bit for us?
In my mind, I'm thinking that untapped in that there's just a wealth of talent, skill, the competence level, at least in my experience, maturity level for homeschoolers tends to be a lot higher. And my thought was that if there was a way to, you know, garner the use of that resource set on a much broader scale. And so when I say untapped, I mean it's not being collectively utilized, at least in my experience as I can see. And again, there may be examples out there that I'm just not aware of.
Okay, got it. So I think this goes in line with what I'm talking about with the offsite remote cloud computing type of model, right? Where, as you're describing, we've got young homeschool men and women that are at home that have time, that want to learn skills, that have skills, that have the desire to work, but potentially want to work from home. And so there's a lot of models that I see that will harness that, and I see more and more of the back office type services going that direction. So for example, one of the businesses that I'm investing in right now is a search engine optimization business, and basically just, you know, anything to do with online presence management and helping companies to up their visibility in search engine results, et cetera. Now, that kind of work, you know, of building the links, posting content, all that kind of stuff, that can be done and is done by remote workers anywhere in the world today. One of the challenges is, in many cases, with an offshore worker from India, Philippines, Mexico, whatever, they lack the proper context for an American company and, you know, an American website in an American context. So so my thinking is that a superior model is to harness these remote workers. And whether that remote worker is a Christian homeschool young man of 16 years old or whatever it is, it could be a stay-at-home mom, it doesn't matter. Whoever that remote worker is working from home on some type of pay-for-performance model where they get paid for what they do, not just by the hour, because otherwise you have to have all kinds of management layers in there, right? This same concept applies to most back office services. So let's take things like anything of a marketing nature, like I just mentioned, search engine optimization, lead management, et cetera, anything of an accounting nature or bookkeeping, those kinds of services, all of that could be done. Any kind of analysis. And there's many customer service models right now where you can basically from home, from your PC and your broadband connection, dial in to log in through a website and be added to the call queue and start taking calls as a customer service rep. And you're paid by the minute that you're on the call. And so anybody can do that. And usually they have a short training program that you go through online to learn about the customer's products and services and in your Fed call scripts, right, et cetera. But there's all kinds of, situations where using this infrastructure of a web-based software program, a broadband internet access, and working off-site in some kind of a compensation model that says, if you do this, I pay you that much. We're also seeing that, for example, one of my companies, we have all of our accounts payables, which is significant. All of our accounts payable process is done from people working from home. A lot of accounting is now done that way. A lot of tax work is done that way. And so I'd look to that back office, services arena, whether it's accounting, customer services, marketing, anything along those lines does lend itself to anyone wanting to work from home in a remote setting. Did that answer your question?
Yes, very good. Thank you.
All right, thank you, Kelly. All right, we have Brian from Reno, Nevada on the line. Go ahead, Brian.
Hi, Wade. Thanks for taking my call. I've got a question about our service business. We've trained several people in the past 20 years, and some of them are competitors now, and some of them operate in other areas of the country. We're wondering if we might be able to capture some revenue and train people in the service that we do. It's a low-entry cost service. And how would you suggest doing that if you think it is a good idea to do something like that?
Sure, Brian. Let me ask, what kind of business you're in?
Sure. We've done window cleaning for 20 years, and we do from small storefronts that go from $10, $12, $15 to high-rises that go to $2,000, $3,000.
Okay, so in general, what you've kind of described is a bit of a franchise model. I think if I was to restate your question, it would be, I'm in the window cleaning business. Does it make sense for me to start kind of a franchise model where I can get people to pay me to train them and put them in the window cleaning business? Does that make sense? Did I restate that properly?
It does make sense, but I was hoping to do it without either making them employees or franchising and do like a pay per work. We would operate the software for them, and they could go out and do the work. And then, we charge them 10% for handling kind of the back office.
Got it. Okay. I was trying to just kind of restate your question. You're trying to figure out if there's ways of leveraging what you do into additional income streams by setting up people in the business and training them and supporting them as they do what you do. So let me just kind of lay out a couple of top-of-mind thoughts. One is that typically where we see a franchise, there's a couple things about a franchise. You typically see a franchise where it's a complex business that requires a lot of knowledge, and so therefore people are willing to pay for a franchise to get all of the supporting system structure, the whole business system. If you buy a McDonald's franchise, it's very expensive, but you will be given all of the tools, all the manuals, all the how-tos, all the step-by-step of how to run a successful McDonald's franchise. So the value of the franchise, part of that value, it comes in many forms. One is the brand, the advertising by the overall McDonald's brand, et cetera. But a lot of the value is that you will be told how to do it, right? And so generally, you see in a franchise model a more complex business rather than a simple business model. So to the extent that cleaning windows is a very simple process and a very simple business model, it would not lend itself well to some sort of a model like a franchise. Now, franchising itself is hard to do. It's very expensive just to set up a franchise, right? Your offering agreement, et cetera. Usually, I'm told it's about $250,000 to set up a franchise agreement. I have not personally done one, but that seems to be the going rate. So you want to make sure if you go down that path, you're investing a lot into a potential deal. But in general, I don't think that a window cleaning business sounds like it's complex enough to have someone buy into that kind of model. Now, what else do we have on the spectrum? So let's say franchise is all the way over to the right, and all the way to the left is we just simply hire the employee. What else is in the middle, you might ask, right? Well, certainly you could take a guy that you could say, if you come to work for me for a period of time, I'll train you how to do this, and then I'll launch you out on your own, and the payback is I simply get a revenue royalty on what you do for a period of time. It might be, you know, capped in terms of total amount. It might be capped in terms of the number of years or the length of time, right? But there might be some kind of agreement up front, right, which says, you know, you're very entrepreneurial. You want your own business. Here's how it works. And then to kind of figure out a way where, now, he might say, well, why would I pay you anything? Why don't I just come to work for you, learn it, and leave and do my own thing? So potentially the exchange there, the negotiation is, what are you giving him in exchange? Now, if you say, well, I've already got proven software systems, you know, we're back to that back office services arena, right? I'm going to help support you. Now, one of the things that oftentimes an owner-operator, you know, basic service like window cleaning, oftentimes those kinds of companies, their weakest link is getting customers in the door. It's lead management, right? And another weak link is servicing the customer from the back office. So oftentimes a guy is really good at cleaning windows or really good at doing the plumbing, but he's not very good about calling to say I'm running late, or not very good about getting the invoice out the door, and not very good about collecting the invoice, i.e. this sort of back office stuff, right? Customer service, accounting, marketing, right? Those kinds of things that will help him really run his business effectively. In most cases, they do the thing, whatever it is they're doing. They're cleaning windows, they're repairing cars, and so the weak link is often that back office. So one thing that you might want to do is to say, are there things you could do? Have you learned about how to get customers in the door? Can you offer lead management services, accounting services, customer service services? You know, what is it about your platform that you've perfected that you could offer to this guy? Then you could say, come work for me for a period of time. Maybe it's 6 months. And maybe say, here's your path, right? Come to work for me as a window cleaner. Do that for 3 months. Then for 3 to 6 months, manage a crew. Then for 3 to 6 months, manage the manager of the crew chief, right? And then once you've done that, you're prepared, and that's maybe a year or so. Here's the pay structure. Here's, you know, how it works. Here's kind of a range of how long you'll be in each position. And at the end of that, then I'll help put you into business. I'll sell you a book of business. I'll give you a customer list to start with, right? And I'll help run your back office services, and here's my fee structure. All of that can be done without a franchise model, and it's more of a service level agreement, royalty agreement, or, you know, something along that nature, right? So does that make sense, Brian?
Yes, very much so. Thank you.
Okay, thank you, Brian, for your call. This is Venture Radio. We're talking about Christian entrepreneurship, equipping Christians and encouraging Christians as entrepreneurs. Okay, Adam from Valparaiso, Florida. Adam, welcome to Venture Radio. And what do we have today for you?
Well, Wade, you talked about how people are looking to alternative investments. People are moving their money to gold. They're getting out of cash. They're getting out of stocks. They're getting out of bonds and that sort of thing. Let's say that you are an entrepreneur and you have an idea. How do you tap into that available capital from this sort of decentralized source? Is it advisable? Is it a good idea to try to gain some of that capital for use in your business? And what are your thoughts on that?
Yeah, very good question, Adam. So, you know, in general, I do get a lot of questions about raising capital. And the context of your question is, okay, given the environment, right, given a downturn, raising capital. So first of all, capital is extremely hard to raise. Only 1 in 4,000 entrepreneurs seeking capital are successful in getting it. It is a very tall hill to climb. So that's normal, whether it's a boom environment or a bust environment. And capital is even harder to raise in a bust environment, in a recession, in a downturn. But that's not to say it's impossible. I'm raising capital now for a company that we just funded and, in fact, oversubscribed the round. But, you know, what's interesting is that it's a food production business, and it's a kind of basic goods, basic services thing that's in demand, and demand will remain for that, or so, you know, we think as the investors in the company. So it's not impossible. It's just harder. So here's a couple of rules of raising capital. And this is the way I kind of try to describe it, just to set the stage for really how difficult it is. When you go to a potential investor, you have to have one of the best ideas that investor has seen all year. A typical institutional investor, venture capital investor, and even an angel investor, a kind of a wealthy individual that likes to invest in early stage businesses. Those types of investors have a lot of ideas coming across their transom all the time. And so there's an abundance of ideas. And so the challenge for the entrepreneur to get capital is that that entrepreneur's idea has to be about the best idea they've seen in a long time. And the other thing, a typical investor is not going to invest in a lot of ideas at any one time. A typical institutional venture capital firm, that's the kind of firm that raises an investment fund from limited partner investors, i.e. typically pension funds, insurance companies, you know, endowment funds, et cetera, and invest that in a fund that fund is invested in early stage startups, right? That typical kind of company will only invest in a handful of deals all year long, you know, four deals, five deals, depends on the size of the fund, obviously. But if you had a typical fund with a couple of general partners and three or four other professionals and maybe a $250 million under management, they're going to be hard-pressed to do more than five deals in a year. An angel investor, you know, two deals a year, maybe three or four deals a year. And you get an angel investor is kind of a typically a wealthy individual, wealthy executive that likes to invest in early stage companies and typically in an industry that they know well, right? So you have to have one of the best ideas that investor has seen in a long time just to get their interest because of the pipeline of ideas flowing across their desk. Secondly, you have to be one of the best entrepreneurs that investor has seen all year, right? They're really looking at two things. They're looking at your idea, your opportunity, your business model, and then they're looking at you. And in both cases, you have to be about the best thing they've seen in a very long time. So that's kind of just back to some basic rules of how difficult it is. So now, one contextual thing going on right now is to, you know, really understanding this whole government funding thing. Because, you know, it's very interesting to me. At the top of the hour, I talked about this broadband access thing that I'm working on, this opportunity to, you know, put in place wireless broadband in my local area. And there's a lot of economic development funds and local funds and county funds and regional funds, earmarked stimulus funds, et cetera, for that kind of opportunity. So there are other sources besides just angel investors and institutional investors that you might want to, you know, take a look at. But, you know, the caution with any kind of government funding, number one, it could take forever, right? Lots of red tape. You got to be very patient. You got to fill out all the right forms. It's a real hassle. In many cases, they'll have some really odd rules. They'll have rules that you have to have, you know, so much equity investment and so much debt at such and such a level, and they're looking for some very specific things depending on what their thesis is for what they're going to do with those funds. And so you got to really play by their rules, right? And again, you'd be yoking with an ungodly civil government, right? So it's, there's a lot of potential issues with that as a creative funding source. But right now, one of the things I do see a lot of activity in is angel investors. It's wealthy guys that are basically saying, I don't like the stock market. I can't tell you how many guys have told me that they've gotten completely out of the public equities stock market right now. And they're saying, I'm on the sidelines, I'm trying to figure out what to do. But when they see something that they know fits with what they know and what they know is in demand, then they'll make a move. And so, you know, I would say if you've got an opportunity that fits that, and then you know angel investors that are interested in that, then you have a much better chance of raising capital. So one fair question, Adam, is, well, how do I find out who the angel investors are and how to get dialed into them? And that's difficult. But there are, if you're in a major metro area, Valparaiso is not exactly major metro area in the panhandle there, but there are in major metro areas angel investor groups, and you can get tapped into them that way. I know on our website, newventurelab.com, we have a LinkedIn group and a Facebook page, et cetera, and there's ways of getting connected with each other, right, and trying to raise capital from each other. So it's not impossible, but extremely difficult. Now, what that leads me to is you might say, well, I got no hope. I got an opportunity, but I don't have capital. But I would go down the path of really getting creative. And as we talked about the Venture Academy back in March, there was a whole section on a presentation on how to raise capital creatively. And in most cases, it's not actually raising capital, but it's structuring a deal in a way that reduces the need for capital, and it's really looking for who's got what I need and how can I get it from them at, little or no cost. Can I give them a revenue share, a royalty? How do I pull together all the constituents, all the players in a particular situation to pull off this opportunity? And so that's where, if you look at the kinds of businesses that got started in the Great Depression, many of them embrace that kind of creative capital model to say, the one thing I do know is that there's not a lot of capital available, so therefore I'm going to be really creative. So I think in the crucible of a downturn, creativity tends to come to the fore. And so I'd be glad to work with you, Adam, offline and just trying to deal specifically with your opportunity, but that would be a couple of thoughts.
Okay, thank you very much.
Thank you, Adam. You are listening to Venture Radio. This is Wade Myers, your host, and we are all about equipping Christian entrepreneurs. All right, we have Jason from Andover, New Jersey on the line. Jason, go ahead, please.
Thanks for taking my call, Wade. I'm particularly interested, as you mentioned, in mega trends or macro trends in the economy. And one of the things you mentioned earlier in the hour was how demand for non-discretionary spending often will increase because the funding that was going towards discretionary spending has been cut and an increase in demand in other areas. And I'm particularly interested in the food market because it's one thing that is non-discretionary for everybody. And I'm wondering if you can maybe throw out some thoughts about potential venture opportunities in the food market. And particularly, I'm thinking that the need for affordable food and solutions to save money on food for families is going to increase. So what are your thoughts on that?
Well, yeah, certainly people have to eat, and food is an area that will continue to be invested in. There's a couple of things going on in this given this context, right? Some people are saying, I want to try to produce my own food to save money and to be less dependent on the infrastructure and on, our country, on the retail grocery store, et cetera. So you see a real increase in what I would call kind of, simple living, homesteading, starting a backyard garden, et cetera. So, and certainly that takes investment, buying a greenhouse, doing those kinds of things. And that's something that we're doing personally just to teach our kids those skills as well as just to have a more ready food supply. So certainly you can do that as an individual investor, just investing in your own ability to produce. And then there's a whole, have you heard of CSAs, the Community Supported Agriculture?
Yes, I actually know a few people that are doing that.
Right, so there's a whole trend into kind of, it's almost like, turning the clock back to a simpler day when you bought your food local and you bought it from a local producer. So we have a family near us that we are part of their CSA, so typically it's a six-month program. You start kind of mid-May, it goes through mid-October, and, whatever they're growing and whatever they're harvesting that particular week is what you get. So you pay, I think it's about $800 for the season, you get a bushel basket full of, fresh produce, et cetera. So we see lots of models like that where it's just creative, local production of, perhaps it's an unemployed man and his family saying, okay, we're just going to roll up our sleeves and start producing something. And in terms of general investment, now, are you looking for a specific early stage opportunity or to invest in companies? Let's kind of direct the question a little bit more, Jason.
Oh, I'm particularly interested in leveraging technology to provide a service that people are going to need that they haven't really considered before. And I'm thinking that in particular because a lot of people don't really think about food costs all that much until their budget really gets pinched, which people are starting to face that more and more. I'm particularly interested in what opportunities might be available for offering a service that will help people save money, whether that's some kind of a subscription website where they help them plan out their food and get maybe bulk food so they can find food at better rates, maybe so they can find CSAs in their local area, those kind of things. And I'm wondering what your thoughts are on how that might be able to be done and where to focus in that kind of niche of cost reduction in the food realm.
Okay, got it. So really we have two kind of forces at play. Your idea says I'm in this cost reduction mode, so I want it to be kind of a cost reduction play, and I'm attacking food, which is typically the number kind of two or three or four item in terms of the largest item of a consumer budget. So first of all, you're targeting an area that consumers spend a lot of money on, so that's good, and you're targeting something that consumer behavior is doing right now, which is trying to cut costs, so that's good. Then you might say, okay, what kind of business model is the most superior business model to try to offer a service in that particular arena? And one of the things that I often say is you want to look to stuff like we cover in our venture analysis on newventurelab.com, which walks you through taking an idea and really analyzing that along several dimensions. And so merely producing food for yourself isn't really going to have a lot of impact. You're trying to serve a broader audience. So, and even producing food for a broader audience is a very difficult business model. It's labor intensive. You got to buy a lot of inputs, et cetera. So one area that I typically would go to that's the most scalable, the most profitable, the most repeatable is some sort of a web-based or software service that enables somebody to achieve that end, right, i.e. saving money on food. And right now some of the most popular websites are couponing websites, the shopper websites, the cost savings websites, kind of the tips for how to save money, and menu websites, a thousand things to do with rice and beans, right, to save on your budget, et cetera. So I do think that if you're trying to invest time, effort, and energy into doing something to serve the consumer need of cutting their food costs, I would tend to look to doing it in an automated software-based fashion rather than labor-intensive production-based around food. But I'd also say it sure would be nice if, Jason, for you and your family, you had, your garden and a couple of your animals just as a fallback, right? But in terms of how to serve a broader audience, that is a very popular type of web-based business right now. And how you structure that business model, there's a million ways to do it. Some are, free content, and it's ad-supported, like with Google, AdSense, et cetera. Some are subscription-based, where you charge the consumer subscription for whatever it is, your meal planning, your couponing service. So there's a lot of different business models that you could embrace for how to do that. I'd also say the space is probably pretty crowded right now at this stage in the game because we've been in a downturn for a while. So you could certainly do some search statistics research to see what kind of sites get, the most hits, what kind of keywords are being searched on, right, et cetera. And so that will help direct you down a path and kind of focus you more. So with that, I think we're out of time for this hour. You have been listening to Venture Radio. Our aim is to equip Christian entrepreneurs and to encourage you and edify you on your entrepreneurial journey. This is Wade Myers, your host for today for Venture Radio, and thank you for joining us.